Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It was not that long ago that support for U.S. environmental efforts had strong bipartisan support. But today, the relationship between movement conservatism and the green movement is one of the most polarizing relationships around. My guest terms it the Great Estrangement. But Frederick Rich would like to change that. The international corporate attorney and environmental leader has a foot in both camps. And for American progress in confronting climate change, he says it's essential that the green movement be a bipartisan movement. That means the conservative movement has to reject climate change deniers and participate in the process. And the environmental movement has to accept that participation and be willing to accept incremental but meaningful changes. He calls it a center-green approach, and he has four short-term goals, which include reducing coal as a power generation fuel, embracing natural gas as a transition fuel, increasing fuel efficiency standards and carbon sequestration, and prioritizing the fight against deforestation. He outlines his thesis in the book Getting to Green, Saving Nature, a Bipartisan Solution. It's published by Norton. Frederick Rich is my guest today. Frederick Rich, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Delighted to be with you, Rich.
You opened your book, Getting to Green, with a discussion of the last major piece of legislation that was bipartisan passed on environmental issues, and that was the 1990 Clean Air Act, in which people like Mitch McConnell voted for it. All sorts of Republican support for the Clean Air Act, which actually helped deal with acid rain. What has happened in the intervening 25, 26 years in which environmentalism and conservative politics have become so estranged?
Well, that's a big question, and it's a very complicated answer, but I think we all know the results. You know, the environment went from being an issue that Richard Nixon said was, you know, beyond class, beyond party, to, in many ways, the ultimate wedge issue. It's a polling that's done on the degree of partisan divide on different topics. The last Pew poll had environment as one of the top two things on which Republicans and Democrats disagree most, meaning that according to this Pew poll, they disagree about it more than they disagree about the scope of government, immigration, religiosity, taxes. So it went to you know, what in my view is a very bad place, and it is a politics that has had some pretty terrible real-world effects. We haven't had a major piece of federal environmental legislation for 25 years. Actually, just a few weeks ago, there were amendments, finally, to the Toxic Substances Control Act. But this is despite the fact that right and left both agree that our 1970s-era environmental laws need to be brought up to date. But for 25 years, we had a complete drought. A lot of people, Rich, think this was all just about climate change. But it's not. It extended to the whole scope of environmental policy in the country.
So getting back, you've pointedly mentioned that majority leader Mitch McConnell voted for the Clean Air Act in 1990, which provided for cap and trade when it came to acid rain. And now if you brought up anything that involved cap and trade, say on CO2 emissions or probably anything else, he wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. What has changed that mindset?
And Rich, let me just make the point. This is not just ancient history, because you know, a lot of my audience, when I've been talking about the book 1990, I might as well be talking about 1890. But you know, as recent as 2008, I mean, John McCain's Republican platform in 2008 had cap and trade for greenhouse gas emissions as one of its three top planks. You know, there was bipartisan support for carbon legislation throughout the 2000s. But the politics went particularly bad right after 2008. Now, let me try to finally answer the question that you've been trying to ask, which is, you know, why? What really went wrong here? And the thing about the book, Rich, is that I do not play a blame game. There's plenty of blame to go around on both sides, and that's a key message. I mean, yes, did movement conservatism and the rise of so-called movement conservatism in the 90s contribute? Of course it did, right? You know, at its extremes, all regulation was seen as quasi-socialistic. You know, any expansion of the scope of government was seen as a bad thing. Private property became this kind of fetishized, you know, absolutist concept that it had never been in the history of the country. And all these contributed to conservatives withdrawing their support from environmental policy, types of environmental policy they had supported. But it wasn't just the right. You know, as the right kind of dropped out of environmentalism, this allowed the movement itself to shift to the left. And, Rich, one of the points I make in the book is that when people on the right, you know, say that environmentalists don't care about people, that they don't care about jobs, that they don't care about the economy, you know, that's painting a big movement with a broad brush, but there is some basis to say that. The extreme left parts of the environmental movement itself have given the right plenty of ammunition. I mean, before my book came along, you know, the best-selling environmental book was by a woman called Naomi Klein called This Changes Everything. And it was a book that basically asserted that we could never save the planet if the capitalist system remained intact, and that the number one enemy of the planet was the whole concept of the global corporation. And, you know, lest you think that that was just, she's a, you know, quite an extreme Canadian journalist, but, you know, the dean of the Yale School of Forestry wrote a similar book. So, you know, there has been this strain of anti-capitalism, you know, anti-corporatism in the environmental movement that, in my view, we have to ditch to get back on track, that wasn't there between, you know, 1880 and 1980.
But you actually admit in the book that a lot of those wild claims are from the fringe, and what movement conservative voices do is say this represents the mainstream view of the conservation movement and the green movement.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, I mean, I've been an environmentalist for 30 years, and I was a Wall Street corporate lawyer for 30 years, you know, working for corporations. Now, I saw both sides from the inside. And, you know, there's a huge center. I mean, the thoughtful mainstream environmental movement today completely understands that they have to have the movement be about people. They have to be attentive to the needs of people. I tell lots of stories in the book about environmental scientists having epiphanies where, you know, it's not all about the snail darter, it's about people and it's about their jobs. We have environmental movements. I noticed, Rich, that you had done an interview, I think last month, with a local sustainability advocate, you know, talking about the triple bottom line. Well, that's nothing new. And, you know, we see both corporations and environmentalists starting to align on this. You know, a lot of corporations completely understand that they can't have economic growth without a sound environmental foundation. And lots of environmentalists understand that we're not going to save the world unless we have technology and innovation and wealth and growth and all the things that capitalism brings us. So, you know, we have to give a megaphone, Rich, to those people in the center. You know, they are not the ones who are heard in the debate at the moment.
And this is one of the things your book points out, is that even though there is this huge divide between, say, Republican stalwarts and Democratic stalwarts or liberal stalwarts on their approach to the green movement and environmentalism, when you talk to average people about their own sort of feeling about it, if they're not in one of these two camps, most people who would describe themselves as even, you know, they vote Republican. They have this high approval rating for environmental efforts. So there's this disconnect.
You know what the disconnect, I think, is, Rich, and is part of my analysis in the book, you know, lays this out. It's the difference between goals and means. You know, we all want clean water. Look at what happened in Flint, right? I mean, do you know anybody who doesn't care about the quality of the water their children drink, right? And I mean, these are universal concerns. So what the path forward is to actually get the right to say once again, not that these aren't problems, and this is where I think the right went very wrong. You know, in 1990, they didn't say acid rain is not a problem. They said, we don't want to allow this to destroy the economy, and let's use market-based tools to solve the problem efficiently, right, with an eye toward the economy and jobs. And you know, it was a great success. What's happened now is that the right has disengaged. It doesn't even have a seat at the table. You know, the voices we have that are advocating solutions to climate change are basically voices on the left, because they're the only people involved in the dialogue. So don't get me wrong. You know, I don't think that the right should just sign up for the environmental agenda whole hog. What I think that the right needs to do is come back to the table and make sure that their principles and their ideas are part of the discussion, because if we're going to, you know, largely decarbonize the economy over the next 50 years, That's a big project. There is legitimate disagreement about how to do it, how fast to do it, how much we should pay to do it, the tools we use should do it. We ought to be having a robust debate between left and right. And, Rich, one of the things that I'm starting to see, you know, you said earlier I must be an optimist, but there are a significant number of Republicans and conservatives who understand this and who want a seat at the table. 12 Republican congressmen tabled a resolution last year, 2 weeks before the Pope came, basically saying, look, you know, climate change is an issue, and we conservatives need to have a seat at the table and bring our values to bear to solving it. There are probably 8 to 12 GOP senators that are ready to take the leap and engage on climate change. There is really thought leadership on the right. There's a former congressman named Bob Inglis. He was a Tea Party guy, but he understands the challenges of climate change and sea level rise, and he founded a group called Republic N. He advocates, for example, not cap and trade, but a revenue neutral carbon tax. So it gives a price to carbon, lets the market do its magic, and yet doesn't grow the size of government because the tax doesn't go into the federal coffers. So that's the kind of creativity and engagement we need to come up with solutions.
You know, you mentioned Flint, Michigan just a moment ago. You know, if we would have put that event 30, 40 years ago, that would have been a galvanizing event, much like the Cuyahoga River catching on fire in Cleveland, which led to, you know, the first Clean Water Act. And now there have been legislative committee meetings about it, but any legislation has had poison pen amendments attached to it where nothing got done. Yeah. And you know, Flint is not an outlier. There are hundreds of communities that have faced the same problem with, say, lead leaching out into their water systems.
It's true, and it is part of the price that we have paid for this 25 years of inactivity. It's true that, you know, as long as we have the degree of partisanship in general that we now have in Washington, it is not easy to do things, even things like addressing lead in water, which is, as you say, is and ought to be a galvanizing issue. But on the other hand, there are other things that have been done. These recent amendments to the Toxic Substances Control Act, it was really fascinating because they were supported by the chemical industry. There was a good deal of engagement between the two parties. There was a compromise reached, and even in this election season when, you know, the sort of common view is it's impossible to get that kind of legislation passed, it happened. So it can happen, but Rich, you know, we need leadership. You know, things don't just happen. They happen because we have political leaders. And, you know, for most of the century, we had important political leaders on both the right and the left who cared about conservation. You know, I mean, Ronald Reagan said, you know, quoted one of his favorite conservative philosophers who said there's nothing more conservative than conservation. We had Teddy Roosevelt,
right,
the greatest conservation president in history, who was a Republican. And so one of the things I call for in the book that I see as an opportunity is for individual Republican politicians to reassert leadership in this sphere. And, you know, that's how things change. Which sometimes it's interesting. You know, I've been on a national book tour talking about this book, and one of the things I found that young people especially, they've never really seen the federal government govern. All they've seen is the type of, you know, partisanship, like you said, you know, putting toxic amendments on every bill and resulting in nothing ever getting done. And there was a degree of cynicism there, which was quite shocking to me. But how you break out of that, it requires each side leadership. You can't have leadership on the environment coming simply from the left. You know, my view is that nobody on the right has ever been persuaded by Al Gore's PowerPoint slides. You know, I think we need, and I think they're right. I mean, God bless Al Gore. You know, he's tried very hard for a long time. But what social science and moral psychology teaches us, that when we have big shifts, like Southern Democrats moving to the Republican Party, or the shift away, my gosh, 40 years we went from integration to an African-American president. We saw, you know, enormous shift recently in attitudes on marriage equality. You know, these shifts are possible. They do happen, but they require leadership from within the community. So if you style yourself a conservative, a patriot, a Tea Party member, you need people who you trust, who share your values, to start talking about environment. And that's why I'm so encouraged by Ed Inglis. You know, it was fascinating when he got back from Antarctica and stood up in one of the most conservative districts in South Carolina. You know, he didn't talk about the science. He talked about his values. You know, he stood up and said, look, this is what I've learned. You know, these are the facts. And, you know, my moral compass tells me I have to do something about this. And so we have an opportunity. There are a number of faith-based groups that have shown incredible leadership again on this. But again, they're talking the language of the right, and they're arguing from a place of values, just as the Pope did in that wonderful encyclical last year.
My guest today is Frederick Rich. He's an international corporate lawyer and environmental leader and the author of Getting to Green, Saving Nature, a Bipartisan Solution. It's published by Norton, which he argues that the conservatives movement needs to come back to the conservation and environmental movement. And he sort of refers to this divide between environmentalists and conservatives as the great estrangement. You have some criticisms of the green movement as well. The Keystone XL pipeline, which you said it was a tremendous diversion from the more important environmental issues because Canada was going to continue to develop the oil tar fields, whether that pipeline was built or not. It was not going to have any difference on climate change. It was just a matter of the efficiency of how you pipe that material, and now that material is coming by train on tank cars.
Right, exactly.
When the economics allow it, which are not necessarily the case right now.
Yeah. Look, in one hand, the Keystone Pipeline the effort to defeat it serve to reconnect some young people and college students, which is a good thing. I really regret, though, that Bill McKibben and 350.org chose the pipeline as the cause, because it was a symbolic cause. And when they won a symbolic victory. And in my view, this is something that we absolutely have to change. We have to go back to the time when the environmental movement was winning real victories, things that changed the world. I start with that 1990 incident because it actually changed a real problem in the real world. We had forests in the Northeast recover. We had clean water start to recover. We actually solved an environmental problem. Keystone was something that even its proponents at the end said, you know, we've just drawn a line in the sand. We have to do something about climate change. We've drawn a line in the sand. And that, you know, it was just irrational. We should have worked on something that actually contributed greenhouse gas emissions, which the Keystone Pipeline didn't. Even the New York Times said its contribution to greenhouse gas emissions would be infinitesimal, and arguably it wasn't even, would have been environmentally more sound than alternative. So I'd like to see us work on things. I think we need to be practical. Another example I give in the book is fracking. There are many problems. I mean, you're in Oklahoma. You know better than I do. That fracking is not going to stop. You know, we as a nation, fracking is a tool that the energy industry is going to continue to use. So all of this talk about, you know, banning fracking is just the green movement, you know, banging its head against a concrete wall. On the other hand, does fracking require enhanced and better regulation and enforcement of existing regulations? You know, absolutely. And so there's an example. You know, I think the environmental movement should engage deeply in advocating, better inspection of well casings, you know, controls over where fracking occurs and where it doesn't occur, giving budgets to environmental regulators to enforce existing regulations, working on wastewater, working on the seismic effects, which you in Oklahoma have, you know, tremendous experience with. Right? These are things that the environmental movement should be working. When they stand up and they say ban fracking, you know, who's listening to them?
Well, let me ask you about how to bridge this great estrangement. One of the things you write in the book is the fact that because the right has moved out of the movement and become antagonistic to the movement itself has moved left. Right. And to get back to the center green approach, the thing you're talking about, that will require movement of the environmental movement to things like cap and trade, which has sort of been discounted from both sides to a degree. I mean, you're looking at more carbon taxes and more stringent efforts to control climate change on the left. The right won't consider that either. Would the environmental movement re-accept conservative ideas. I think of another one that comes to mind is people on left and right would say we got to get away from coal, burning coal, to mitigate climate change. But you see the environmental movement also saying, oh, natural gas, the natural bridge fuel, is also bad. How do you get to these sort of common sense conclusions when one side is moved because the other side isn't participating?
Well, you know, the other side has to start participating. And if it starts participating, things will change. Mm-hmm. And also it's a question of voices. You know, the Sierra Club, which did, you know, Beyond Coal, which was something I supported, it's a dirty fuel and has many other environmental consequences. And if there's anything we should try to get beyond, it's coal. When they then piled on and said Beyond Gas, you know, it was a catastrophic mistake. You know, the natural gas revolution has been the only thing that has decreased America's greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, it's the market that and the market and our ability and the market price of gas, which has resulted in the shutdown, as you know, of so many coal plants. So this sort of lack of sophistication, this you know, everything is a campaign, everything is a slogan, as opposed to deep engagement as a policy matter. I mean, after all, the Obama administration in 2008 recognized and endorsed gas as the transition fuel to a renewable economy, which is what most sensible people do. So I know you're asking, you know, how do we break out of this? Well, I think that moderate environmental organizations have to step up their own voices. I think they have to criticize. There's been a reluctance within the movement to criticize each other. I think mainstream environmental groups should have criticized the Sierra Club when it went for its Beyond Gas campaign. And, you know, it's not, you know, Rich, here's the thing to remember. We're not trying to take the country to a place where it's never been before. We're just trying to go back to where we were for most of American history, through about 1980, which is where, you know, both sides recognized these environmental issues as priorities, you know, brought different philosophical and ideological and prescriptions to their solution and engaged heavily and compromised and took actions. You know, one of the things is the environmental organization, the movement over time has developed an antipathy to compromise. It's sort of a dirty word. Well, that has to change. You know, Bill Clinton said famously, the U.S. Constitution should be subtitled, "Let's Make a Deal." And you know, I think he had it just right. So compromise has been a dirty word. That's a problem with the movement. And incrementalism has been something, you know, they want it all. The glass is always half empty as opposed to half full. And in my view, whether it's on changing energy policy and moving toward renewable fuels or, you know, incrementalism is the way to go. Take what progress you can make. I say in the book that I apply a two-part test to proposals, policy proposals. One, would it make a real-world difference in an important environmental issue, right? Would it actually help solve a problem in the real world? And number two, is it politically feasible? So if it doesn't pass those two tests, I don't think the environmental movement should be putting its money and its efforts and its advocacy behind it. But there are plenty of things that can meet those two tests. And, you know, do they avoid climate apocalypse? No, but that's not a ground not to do them. If we can make some progress, we have to take progress where we can find it and not go for these big global solutions. It is possible to get bipartisan support for regulations that will result in the worst and most polluting coal plants being shut down. You know, there are tons of things that we can do in terms of sea level rise and adaptation. You know, it's fascinating how quickly the debate over, you know, is climate change real, disappears once you've had a taste of sea level rise. I mean, if you're living in San Diego or Miami Beach, it's interesting up here in the Hudson Valley, the northern part of the Hudson Valley, we have very conservative politics by and large, and we had, you know, major populations that were still quite skeptical about climate change. It was fascinating. My organization, after Sandy and Irene, we had 2,000-year storms in 2 years, and basically people observing the effects of sea level rise, we just passed through that question of whether climate change is real and went right to the question, what ought we to do? And not only what ought we to do as a nation, but, you know, what we ought to do as communities. You know, what I see is Republican mayors in Miami Beach and San Diego and other places really showing leadership in climate change because they're dealing with its consequences. So they're all illustrations, Rich, of the point, you know, find something that can be done because it's politically feasible and do it. And don't get too caught up in the problem that it's not enough. You know, Freud said insanity is, you know, doing the same thing over and expecting a different result every time, right? And what did we do? We tried to get national legislation on greenhouse gas emissions in 2003. It failed. 2005, it failed, right? 2007, it failed. And then, you know, even in 2009-10, when you had Democrats in control of both houses of Congress, you know, a Democratic progressive president who made climate change one of his top priorities, they couldn't even bring the bill to the floor of the Senate. Yeah. So, you know, do we just keep doing that? Do we just keep going to, you know, international conferences, you know, or do we try something else? And of course, that's what the rest of the world is doing. You know, while we've been dithering, the rest of the world has been making tremendous strides in supporting renewable energy, spending money on basic research and development in renewables, you know, implementing, you know, renewable strategies, closing down coal plants, using carbon sequestration technologies where they can. And they're not saying we're not going to do anything, you know, until India and China get its act together. They're acting. And actually, you know, if you look at it from a moral perspective, you know, I think a lot of people who have a strong moral compass believe that it's not an excuse to say I'm not going to act until the other guy does it. If I see a problem and there's something I can do, you know, I ought to take what steps are available.
If you can get to a bipartisan environmental policy nationally, there are still many voices on the right, say our senior senator here in Oklahoma, who don't even believe the science of climate change, of global warming, of anthropomorphic climate change and global warming. Do you just bypass those voices?
Yes. It's the time has been to bypass those voices. You know, those views come from all sorts of reasons, and I don't think it's productive. I think, I'll tell you, in my experience, you know, hitting those voices head on is not the way to go. I think we need to simply engage on the issues. You know, that it's a debate that I think will just fade into irrelevance as the country moves on. You know, it's not supported by the demographics. It's not supported by the Republican Party. I mean, Karl Rove, right? I don't often find myself quoting Karl Rove, but he's certainly one of the smartest political analysts in the world and, you know, a reliable conservative. He said as early as 2009, we have to jettison this quiet denialism because it's a loser politically. I mean, this is his perspective, right? Not because it's incorrect, but because it's a loser politically. And of course, you know, Karl Rove is right. It is a loser politically and has to change.
Corporate attorney and environmental leader Frederick Rich speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His book is titled Getting to Green, Saving Nature, A Bipartisan Solution. It's published by Norton. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.